Well, this morning, we're going to have our last installment of This Is Us for the summer. Of course, these are conversations we're having with different people in the congregation about how God is meeting them in their situations. And it's been good to hear these stories. You know, I think a lot of times, and I've heard this from you, that a lot of times we know sort of the basic sketch of the story of the people we come in contact with, but we don't always know the depth or the detail of it. And so it's been fun to hear the stories at a greater depth and a greater detail, and then just to hear how God is working in the hard things of life. So today we're going to have a visit with Jared Ayton. Come on up, Jared. Going to have a visit with Jared. And most of you, I think, probably know him, having grown up here at Bethany. He's very familiar to you, but we wanted to have him come and talk a little bit about his work at the Donald Doucette Center. And maybe a few other things, Jared. So thanks for coming to visit with us. Now, I did get you a cup of water. It's from the New Beginnings Church. It's an African Swahili fellowship, and that's appropriate for reasons we'll get to in a few minutes. So that's your special cup, and you can... Yeah. Thank you. What's your name? Nathan? Is that right? Did I get that right, Nathan? It's really nice to have you here, Nathan. Thank you for coming. You're not here? Okay. Okay. Oh, you're not new. Okay. Well, Nathan, I'm new. Okay. So thank you for welcoming me. Yeah. Yeah. So, Nathan, this is Jared. And do you know Jared already? No? Okay. Well, you're going to hear a little bit about Jared's story. So, Jared, you grew up here in the Sioux, attending Bethany. Maybe give us a few of the key points of challenge and of growth for you as you grew up here at the church.
Okay. It's always a little overwhelming coming up here, Dan, being a shy guy, but we'll get into this. As many of you know, I grew up here, and I have very fond memories of all the years picking out Odyssey cassettes from the library.
Like cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes. Oh, man. Bringing them home and putting them in my little cassette player at home, participating in the Christmas programs that were always put on by Cheryl Scorgi or Nancy Erickson. I have a lot of fond memories of meeting in the kitchen. Our Sunday school program was so big that we actually didn't have a classroom to go to. So we met in the kitchen as young men. And I think I remember Don Elliott and Jonathan Henson overseeing that Sunday school program. So all of these little events, they don't necessarily seem like big spiritual turning points, but looking back, I realize that they've all had an influence in my life over the years. And so thank you, those of you who have been active in my upbringing here. And yeah, thank you for pouring into me all these years.
Now, strangely, a kitchen probably is a very appropriate place for a group of young men to meet.
I don't remember there being any food, though, Dan. I don't think there was food.
Maybe. All right, so you grew up here.
Yes.
And then at some point, you ended up working here for a season. Tell us about that.
Coming home from Briarcrest, I requested if I could do a summer internship, similar to what Colin has done this past summer. And so I worked here for a few months under Dan Collins. He was kind of overseeing and mentoring me. And that eventually turned into a full-time position here as the Director of Youth Ministries. And so I worked here for 4 years, overseeing the children's programs. And again, I thank you guys for being open and willing to take on such a young person and to provide me with that space where I can make mistakes and figure things out. I always felt very supported working here, and it was quite meaningful and impactful to have spent years at Briarcrest studying and then being able to come here and actually put it into practice and to put it under practice under direct mentorship from Pastor Peter. And so that was a very positive experience. And perhaps looking back and thinking about it, one of the highlights of those 4 years was that Peter requested that I spent every one of my days, a portion of my day, reading and journaling. And often, as a young person, you wouldn't necessarily take time to journal your thoughts. And that developed a habit in me that I'm still journaling up to today and reflecting and reading, and I have a bunch of these books now. I think I'm halfway through my fourth one. And I want to just read one. This one isn't, to be honest, I chose this one because it's shorter. Just to give you a glimpse of what it was like for me to have that time and space to read and journal before trying to pour out what I've learned into the kids here. So this is actually from August 24th, 2015. Back in my office, ready to start a whole new year, Lord, make me ready. I spent the morning reading Luke chapters 4 through 6. So much of it is about loving each other. The Sermon on the Mount passage is all about loving each other as God loved us. I read about the healings and could imagine God's laughter as these people are freed from their physical prisons. Mm-hmm. I could sense God's love and concern for these people and his deep delight in their faith. The passage that struck me the most was chapter 4, verse 38 and 39. Jesus left the synagogue and went to the home of Simon. Now Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they asked Jesus to help her. So he bent over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her. She got up at once and began to minister to them. I imagine Jesus looking at this woman with compassion and tenderness, a love for her that is beyond words. I wonder at the inexpressible joy of Jesus when he witnesses the smile that stretched across her face as she got up from the bed, refreshed and healthy. He was a daughter to him. It reminds me of the old Muslim man suffering from ALS who I met in Jordan. I had compassion for him, felt concern and even some kind of love, but the Lord's was exceptionally greater. This is God's love for us in our weakness. This is God's laughter and joy when we take delight in him and in his gifts to us. So again, that's just a little glimpse of what Bethany provided to me in that time. And so again, thank you for letting me come on and experiment what it means to be in ministry. And those 4 years have been very impactful, for the rest of my life.
That's great. I'm imagining at some point 60 years from now or 80 years from now, a volume of sets in the Briarcrest Library that's been published.
There's too many spelling errors for it to be.
What a great practice, though. What a brilliant practice, right? To just, you know, a lot of times we have devotional lives, but in the rush and the busyness, we run our eyes over the words but never get to that point of deeper reflection, which I think journaling helps with. Right?
And they're a treasure to me now, being able to just look back and actually remember what I have learned, because I forget everything. So having a physical copy mm-hmm. that I can, this is what I was learning yeah. in 2015. And how does remembering that teach me something new in the present?
Now, let's go back to Briarcrest for a minute. You had 4 years there of study. That's right?
5 years.
5 years of study?
5 years, yes.
Crunched that four-year degree into 5 years. Perfect.
Yep.
Now, there was this practice called Open Dorms. And I don't know if you remember it, but we would allow, on a particular day, we would allow the girls to go into the guys' dorm just for a couple hours in the evening to have visits, and, you know, like, we would just do this on rare occasions. And one particular night, I happened to be the residence director in Jared's dorm, and so I was kind of doing the rounds, and the girls were in for this open dorms event, and I poked my head into the room, and there's a group of kids there, and this young lady over here was in that room with Jared and a few others, and I was just kind of taking it all in, and I knew Jen, and I knew Jared, and I noticed that every time Jared would speak, like, her attention would just, like an arrow, right to him. And I thought, there's something going on here. And so I watched it. I watched it right in front of me. Now tell us about your life with Jen.
Okay, well, long story short, eventually we started talking, even though I avoided her for a long time. Jen was, she would always say hi to me, and it would frustrate me because she would never say anything else. Like, why would you say hi to somebody who you're not actually talking with or know? But she would always say hi, and eventually I just started saying hi back, and yeah. And so now we've been married for 8 years, 3 kids, Seth, Wesley, and our newest one is Linnea. And yeah, life is good, Dan.
Good. Now, education has played an important role in your life, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about Briarcrest. I wanted you to talk a bit about your experience in Kenya. Where did you go? What did you study? And what came of that for you?
So after working at Bethany for 4 years, we decided as a family to pursue some more education. And I was particularly interested in studying comparing Christianity and Islam. That's what I wanted to dive into. And in order to do that, you would have to live in an Islamic context. And so we decided that we wanted to look at pursuing a Master's of Divinity in an intercultural community. And the place that we found was Africa International University in Nairobi, Kenya. So we packed our bags and we flew over there with a, 6-month-old child, Jen? 4-month-old child. Seth was only 4 months old. And we moved into this very international community with professors from all over the world and students from all over the world. And we spent the next 3 years there studying that program. We learned a lot. We're still processing it. Often Jen and I will still ask the question, okay, well, what did we really learn there? And trying to understand why God had us there and how are we to bring those experiences with us as we move forward. Thinking about AIU, I was wanting to share just one impactful person. It's 3 years, so it's hard to give a glimpse of all that we learned, but there's one person that I would like to share about, and it's just not what I expected. So when we first moved there, we decided not to buy a car, and public transportation was difficult because we had a 4-month-old, and public transportation, you're just on 20 people on these little buses, and they just zip around all over the place, so it's pretty hard to do with a family. So we were connected with a taxi driver, and this taxi driver became our regular person we would call to take us anywhere. And his name was Christopher. And very quickly, Christopher just started to shine. He would share with us his stories. He would protect us from people who would want to overcharge us. And I started to admire him. And his faith started to come out. And he started to tell me about how much he loved Jesus and how active he is, loving his little community. And over time, we realized just how poor Christopher was. He invited us out to his home a few times. And also finding out that he was completely illiterate, not able to read in English or in Swahili, not able to read at all. And yet, here is this man who's on fire for Jesus and is pursuing the kingdom. And so you gotta imagine the irony where you have this graduate student learning and being mentored by a man who's never read the Bible but knows Jesus. And here I am reading all day long. And so that's my relationship with Christopher. He became my best friend over those 3 years. he kind of changed my perspective on my education. Mm. And I wrote a quote here that I think describes the way that I felt. Many often err and accomplish little or nothing because they try to become learned rather than live well. On the day of judgment, surely we shall not be asked what we have read, but what we have done. Mm-hmm. Not how well we have spoken, but how well we have lived. Mm-hmm. So Christopher taught me that all the learning that I was doing, all the reading and studying, must be done to learn how to love. Otherwise, it's wasted on pride and self-improvement. And so, I envied Christopher's love for Jesus and his trust through his sufferings and his poverty. And that really put in perspective that everything I was to do there at AIU, Africa International Community, was to learn how to love and to be more like Christopher. So yeah, that's pretty...
It speaks, I think, to important things about what the nature of education actually is, yeah. Right? That your education could not be divorced from this man who, you know, you're learning and you're seeing his life, and it just comes together in a beautiful way. Yeah, that's great. So that, I suspect, probably impacted decisions for your return then. When you guys came back to Canada, you decided to pursue a role in youth correctional services. Little side story here, when Penny and I first saw the posting at Bethany, I thought it might be Jared's church, and so we contacted you, and I said, Jared, should this be a job that you're applying for? And you said, no, I know where I'm going. And you were quite convinced that God was calling you to this work in a correctional institute. So tell us about that decision.
Just thinking about, again, the purpose of education is to love. A part of the question I started asking myself, especially in my last year at AIU, was what community do I find myself loving by accident? And what kind of kept on coming up was just disadvantaged youth. My 4 years working at Bethany, I had many opportunities and really felt God's empowerment connecting with certain youth who had nobody else cheering for them. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I felt meaningful, and I felt like I kind of fit working with youth. And so there's another quote that became impactful at that time, and it's, God's plan or purpose for you is where your greatest passion meets the world's greatest need. And so one of my greatest passions that I can sense at the time was working with youth. And so our last year in Kenya, we knew we were graduating. We were desiring to come home. Mm-hmm. And I remember praying, laying in my bed underneath the mosquito net, just asking God to direct our family and to provide me with a job that I would find purposeful and meaningful. And it took some time, and finally I saw the job ad, working with youth in the local prison. And I'm like, man, that's the one. And actually, when I saw that job ad, I remembered years ago driving past it and thinking, maybe someday I'll work there. And so I applied for the job, and I ended up having to fly home from Kenya twice, leaving my wife and my son, my very pregnant wife and my son in Kenya, coming home to complete the psychological and physical testing mm-hmm. that's required. And it's one of those things that I was unsure of the way forward, but once it started unfolding, it was like, okay, this is perfect timing. And sure enough, we returned from Kenya in April, I think, March, and I began working in April. And so it was just perfect transition coming into the correctional facility in town.
It's beautiful that you're drawn to that, because I suspect for many of us, we would be running the other way, right? And it's awesome the way God gifts each individual according to the fit that is right for them, right? So I'm not saying it's wrong that I might not be drawn to that. I'm saying it's awesome that God has uniquely prepared you for that work. So tell us then about a bit about the day-to-day, and then about where you see God at work in that.
So the youth correctional system has a completely different philosophy behind it than the adult corrections. The place that I work does not look in any way like the prisons that you would see on television. It's much more like a school. The whole idea is they want these kids to not be reoffenders, and the main reason why these kids are offenders in the first place is because they don't often have families or good relationships with older adults. And so the philosophy behind it is to get some older adults in there living with them 24 hours a day, eating with them, helping them with their schoolwork, playing sports with them. We're with them 24 hours a day, and it's our role, we wear all the hats, it's our role just to try to be an older mentor, and often the first older adult showing interest in these young people's lives. And it sounds fun to help them with their schoolwork and to play sports with them, but it is difficult. These are quite literally the hardest kids to work with. And the only kids that get into this level of custody are the kids that have quite intense histories and crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it, Dan. I love working with these kids and seeing them grow and seeing them spark up when you show them interest and let them teach you something.
Yeah.
One example is I spent the last probably about 3 months teaching this 14-year-old girl how to do the Rubik's Cube. And she spent hours and hours. And she did it. She learned how to do it. And then for the whole next week, she's just walking around the prison showing everybody how she can solve the Rubik's Cube. Just little things like that. Maybe for the first time this girl has something that makes her look smart or has something that makes her feel special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this situation then, where are you seeing God at work? What kinds of things are you observing there?
One of the main things, working at the prison, you see a lot of evil. These kids, yes, they have crimes that they're serving time for. But once you get to know these kids, most of the time, you realize that they're victims. And that in order for these kids to have done these things to get to this level of custody, it's mostly the cause and the result of evil that's been done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to know these kids, spending 24 hours a day with them, and they share their stories, and you see a lot of evil. And you see what happens when selfishness is king. You see what happens when lifting up one's pride is their main purpose or their main goal. And these kids are the victim of that kind of lifestyle. And seeing all that darkness, man, it changes your perspective on a Christian community and on church. That here we have a group of people coming together, and sure, there's things about church that might seem boring or uncomfortable, but when you realize that this is a group of people coming together to pursue good, to pursue living a life that isn't selfish, to pursue being humble, that it really kind of puts in perspective when Jesus talks about his followers being light and salt in this dark world. Or there's another passage from Philippians chapter 2, where it says, "Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation, in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life." So my understanding of the importance of Christian community has grown significantly, being exposed and seeing the evil that's out there and realizing how good this is. A group of people coming together, pursuing to live a life that resembles Jesus and living out his ethics of compassion and forgiveness. We spent, for a season at the prison, we had a lot of kids from Southern Ontario who had been involved in gang violence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would try to make comments about, well, maybe you should practice compassion or forgiveness, because so much of their talk is revenge or winning over their oppositional gangs. And so I'd talk about, like, man, why don't you guys just forgive each other and move on? Which might be naive of me, but the idea of forgiveness and compassion was so outside of their realm of thinking. And just seeing, yeah, church is good. Following Jesus' teachings really do lead to a good and healthy life.
There was a story you told me just before service today, something a young man said to you. Would you just...
This community coming together to pursue good is especially important, I've seen, for children. One of the kids that I've worked with for months, he shared with me his story one evening, and your imaginations are sufficient to fill in the abuse that this kid has been through. And he said to me, he told me to look at him. He's like, "Look at me, Jared, look at me." And he said, "Love your wife, love your kids. Do it for me. Take my life as an example of what happens when you grow up without a family." And man, that was pretty impactful when he said that to me, that this young person knew the importance of family, maybe more than we do. And he just said, "Make sure that you love your kids and love your wife." And that really, again, just made me feel the weight of a Christian community. And again, reflecting on my upbringing here at Bethany, that I had so many adults pouring into my life. Gwen Legacy in the library, an example. Don Elliott, and their family inviting me over for lunch. I could say many. Nancy Erickson teaching me in school and in Sunday school. In that those, the ways that we love our kids, even though it might seem unimpactful, I'm seeing what happens when we don't. And so loving the kids in this community, empowering families, is literally world-changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Wow. it's funny. A young man, you said 14, 15 years old? Yeah. Amazing. Amazing stuff. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask Jared? Nathan, do you have any questions you would ask Jared? Yeah? Go ahead. How about we do that after? Can we do that after? Sorry, I didn't... Yeah, you can talk with Jared after, I think. Oh, yeah, why don't you talk with Jared after? How about that? We're just about finished here. Can we finish up? Okay. Any other questions for Jared? In the back. Can't see you. It's dark. The question is, how detailed can you be about your faith in your job?
I'm not allowed to preach. I'm not allowed to put Christian teaching over other religious belief systems. But at the same time, it's interesting that the mental health idea at the prison is that spirituality is very important for these kids. And so we have a lot of spiritual programs for the kids. And so while I'm not necessarily able to say that I believe this over something else, it's very easy for me just to talk about Jesus's ethics. So I can talk about the fruit of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. I can talk about the importance of forgiveness. I can talk about the importance of having compassion. And it happens quite regularly that these kids come up to you and ask you, well, Jared, do you believe? Or what do you believe? And in those cases, I can share just from my experience. And perhaps one of the most interesting opportunities I've had is these kids tend to grab Bibles and bring Bibles to their rooms almost in a superstitious kind of way. That they think that there's power in it over what they're struggling with or something. And so often these kids will open the Bible, and of course they don't know which way's up or which way's down. And I'll be like, hey, let me read to you something from there that I think is really impactful, and I'll show them how to find it. Maybe I'll even circle it for them and read it to them and pass it back or encourage them to read one of the Gospels. And so in that kind of way, I'm trying to get them to read some of the Bible, or I've snuck in some Christian literature into our library. So I'm doing my best to try to be a light while staying within the expectations as a government employee.
Good. Other questions? Well, Jared, thanks so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. Again, just getting that level deeper in understanding, okay, we know he works there. What does that look like? What does that mean? It's really profound what you've shared with us today. Thanks, man. It's interesting, this convergence, right? Jared kind of talked about this full awareness of what evil looks like in the world. You know, this awareness that there is this evil. It's not pretend, it's real. And he's looked at it. And then also not getting discouraged and not despairing over that, but like actually finding life in this idea that Christian community holds answers and hope, right? That what Jesus gave us to do here actually has answers for our world. So instead of becoming discouraged or despairing, he's given hope. And it made me think of this passage in Romans chapter 12, which ends with this brilliant line that you all know, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So I'm going to read this passage for us, and just as you hear it, just think about that. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And just think about, like, what are the ways we overcome evil? Romans 12, starting at verse 9. Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit and serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. And do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So there's two parts here to Paul's methodology in overcoming evil. It's the way, first of all, that we live as a community, but then secondly, it's also the way that we respond to people who are outside of this community. And so, first of all, within the community, we're to be characterized by love and affection and humility and hard work and rejoicing and patience and prayer and generosity and hospitality. And then the second part of our response to the people outside of our community is to bless those who persecute people, who persecute us, and pray for them and share in their struggles and work to live in harmony and be humble and honorable and live in peace and never take revenge and bless your enemies with food and drink. And then that brilliant line again, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. See, there's this great quote from Nietzsche where he says this, lots of people ponder over this, whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. A lot of times when we're at this work of fighting off evil, we become evil ourselves, right? And there's this great danger that in our struggles, we don't want to take up the weapons of the world to fight against evil. It's so easy, and it's so common, and it comes so naturally to us that when we see evil, we fight it with weapons like rage and anger and bitterness and slander, and that doesn't work. It perpetuates the things that God is against. It's the old saying, she who fights fire with fire ends up with more fire, and we're not about creating fire. We're about putting out fires. So Paul's exhortation for us as Jesus followers is a different kind of arsenal. It's an arsenal of healing forgiveness and hospitality and kindness. This is how God has won, and this is how he intends to win the world. This week, I came across an article in Maclean's magazine. Maybe some of you saw it. It's about this man, Jaskaret Sidhu, the man who was driving the truck that blew through a stop sign, killing 16 members of the Humboldt Broncos hockey team and seriously injuring 13 others. And the story was really asking the question about forgiveness. What is the nature of forgiveness? And for a popular level magazine, I thought they actually did a really good job of wrestling with the complexity of it. The article cites the journey of Scott and Lori Thomas. I think his picture is here, Scott Thomas, whose son Evan was killed that day. And they were given the opportunity to address Mr. Sidhu. They had prepared a letter that was addressed to their son, expressing how much they loved him and how much they had lost. And they were going to read this to Mr. Sidhu. But on the morning of the hearing, the couple came to the conclusion that their son would want instead them to offer to him forgiveness. So that morning, they rewrote the letter. And this, friends, don't imagine this being an easy exercise. Think of the gravity of the loss. Think about rewriting a letter while there's probably still a ton of mixed emotions around it. So they rewrote the letter and offered forgiveness instead, including in the letter their son's Bronco medallion with his number on the back. You see it there. They gave it as a gift. And when they arrived, they found Sidhu on one knee sobbing before them, and they picked him up and they hugged him. And they wept together over the pain of this loss. It's a pretty crazy story. Like, it's really gripping to read it. The Maclean story describes it this way. Sidhu and the Thomases talked about what the Thomases had written, about Evan, their son, about faith. Scott didn't doubt Sidhu's sincerity and gave voice to the message in the letter that he forgives him. Again, I'm quoting the article here. Today, Sidhu looks back on these fleeting moments in the anteroom of a prairie courthouse as a minor miracle, as a pivotal in the setting of the course of his life, as it as pivotal as his sentencing was. He says this, "When I close my eyes, I can see myself standing in that room with Mr. Thomas, and it gives me energy to move forward." Sidhu told McLean's in his first interview since the crash, speaking from Bowdoin Institution, a medium security prison near Red Deer, "The pendant reminds me of my mistakes, and it reminds me of the power of forgiveness." Still quoting the article here, it says, "The result, only 3 years on from the heart-rending trauma, is a surprisingly open conversation about the limits of grief and the usefulness of a deceptively simple-sounding word. What is forgiveness? Who does it serve, and what purpose does it serve?" You might remember Sidhu was initially suicidal after that incident, and he says this now, "From where I'm standing, forgiveness means everything." And there is lots of complexity to this. There are lots of struggles around the nature of forgiveness and what is justice in the course of forgiveness. What does this look like? But what we see here is a man whose life is on a different trajectory because of this. "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And as Jared has talked about these things, these weapons of Jesus, they're to grow and they're to flourish in Christian community. They're to be strengthened and supported and practiced right here in this group among us, right? "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And this, friends, is done with the weapons of Jesus. Let's pray together. Father, this morning we've gathered in order that we might meditate on Jesus. We've gathered in order that we might lift him up as the one whose greatness transcends all others. And so, Lord, that work that you want to do in our hearts to reshape us, to renew our minds in his ways, Lord, do that work in us through the power of your Spirit, that we could be your kingdom of priests in this world. Help us, Father. We are so weak, so very weak. But give us grace and strength to do your good work here. We pray in Jesus' name.